James from Hawke University.
Thank you very much. So, the one instruction. So, that's okay. This paper I'm going to give you is drawn from my MA thesis work, which I just finished up at Carleton in September. And it ends up being like a big thesis where everything seems to be connected to everything else. So my goal here is to pull some of the stuff out into a nice bite-sized chunk and present it as well as I can. And what I've done is pulled out the non-technical stuff. So I hope it'll be interesting to like a general audience. And the topic is philosophy of science, but it's the kind of thing that that anybody should be able to get into, because it's about relating knowledge from different fields together to try and learn something new from both one field or the other. So, the topics that I'm really interested in general are special sciences and sciences that are more specialized than others. There's like a diverse number of them. It just seems that the specialization among the sciences it increases astronomically. If you look over the history of science, this is something that's stunning. It doesn't seem to be slowing down. Maybe 100 years ago, someone really intelligent could claim to know a fair bit about our body of scientific knowledge as a whole. Today, that's kind of hopeless. But if we can't all be specialists, or if we can't all be generalists and everything, then some of us have to specialize in something. But specialization comes at a cost, because it's hard to enter into a conversation about something if you don't know the jargon, if you don't know the specific terms that are specific to this field, if you don't know the methods that they're using. And so what we'd really like to be able to make these kinds of connections, and if you're a biologist, you'd like to be able to apply some of your knowledge of biology to things like chemistry, or some of your knowledge of biology to psychology, and try and make these connections. And there's sciences that specifically are aimed at doing exactly this. Interdisciplinary sciences like cognitive science, where you get psychologists and cognitive psychologists and working together with neuroscientists and specialists in language and artificial intelligence. And they're all trying to work together to tackle this gigantic problem of the mind, which none of these particular fields has had just unlimited success in tackling. It just seems to be such a huge problem. So the hope is, the goal is, that by working together that we can make progress on these things. The thing is that we don't really have a very good conceptual framework, in my opinion, for making these kinds of connections. So my goal here is to do exactly that. And the way that I'm going to do it is in these five parts. First, I'm going to present outline a paper by Oppenheim and Putnam from 1958, which is a really good paper for outlining just kind of the intuitions that people tend to have about how the sciences are connected together. So they're the ones with the hierarchy of sciences, and I'll talk about them, raise some objections, and then try and build an alternative model that answers the objections. My goal isn't really to just to construct a bulletproof argument against their paper. It's been criticized widely, but it's still an important paper. My goal is really just to point out what I see as their mistakes and try and figure out the ways to solve them, and then integrate those solutions into the new model. So after going through the objections, what we're going to do is take a bit of a detour to try and collect the tools that we're going to need to build a new model. That includes talk about complexity, which is a topic that I'm really interested in, the idea of kind of measuring complexity or comparing the complexity of objects at different levels, comparing the complexity of a cell to the complexity of a cat, or the complexity of, I don't know, DNA to individual molecules or individual atoms. And then that will lead to a discussion, kind of a working redefinition of what sciences are and levels are, and that'll lead to the new model. So, 1958, Oppenheim and Putnam come up with this important paper called The Unity of Science as a Working Hypothesis. And they present their paper with all the appropriate hedging and caveats, and I'm going to present their paper a little more high contrast and through the contentious kind of way to draw the points. But their three main points are that they anticipate that there will be an ideal science, pretty much an extension of fundamental physics that would just encompass and explain everything, at least in principle, if not in practice. And they described six levels of organization that we could break the universe down into and then understand it in this way. And that's going to be the hierarchy. And then these levels are going to be connected by a logical relation called micro-reduction, which is how we get a bigger thing and reduce it down to a smaller thing, or reduce an explanation of in terms of like biology down to an explanation in terms of chemistry. How we do that so that we can finally get down to a fundamental unified science that covers all the bases. So, in a little bit more detail, the unity of science involves unity in this kind of weaker sense in terms of unity of language. Everyone in working in this unified science has to be talking, using a vocabulary that covers a full range of phenomena. In a kind of stronger sense, there's a unity of laws, so it is a single science with a single like, body of theory. And then they are asserting that science tends in this direction. So I'm not going to talk about their ideas about unity so much because, in a way, I agree with them. Although I'm not going to, I don't think that we can make quite a strong claim as they do. But that's one of their goals. So they in the paper they talk about what it means for science to be unified. Kind of more interesting, more technical. They describe this micro-reduction relation, which is based on some earlier work. It's kind of the idea. So if you have two theories, T1 and T2, you can reduce it. Reduce T1 to T2, if the vocabulary, if they're not the same, they don't have the same vocabulary, so there's actually like reduction in vocabulary going on. All the observations have to be explained by T1, or explainable, and T1 has to be at least as well systematized. So the classic examples of this kind of thing are like taking a more like specialized field like Newtonian mechanics and then taking relativity theory, and relativity theory explains all of the Newtonian stuff and accounts for all the data. And so that's the kind of reduction and improvement in the theory, because it's talking about things at kind of a lower level of talking about space-time at a lower level than you're needed. Anyway. And not just particular theories, but entire branches of theories can be reduced. So this seems to make sense, at least on the face of it. It's the second one that will be criticized. But this is their micro-reduction relation. And they propose that it's that relation that connects these like six levels, from elementary particles up to atoms to molecules to cells, multicellular living things, social groups. Those are their six levels. So that's the hierarchy that they're talking about. And micro-reduction allows us to go from one to the other. And then these are the rules that they think allow us to like define these levels. So it's not as important how they divide up these six levels. It's kind of more important how the rules that they think apply. So, and it's number four that's kind of an important one. Don't worry about them. They're common sense. They make a lot of sense. Number four is the one we're going to be talking about in the criticism. So, and then the other important thing is that, so we can break down the analysis of these. Eventually, the idea is that we'll have an ideal physics that talks about elementary particles, and it'll be able to talk about all these ones as like special cases. And they talk about like, so we can break it down by micro-reduction. And then there's three processes, evolution, ontogenesis, synthesis, that allow in nature to just create more complex things or less complex things. And so if we understand those processes, we can understand how things are built up, we understand reduction, we can take it down. That's how the unified science should work. But there's three lines of objection to this. These objections are quite different, they're attacking different parts. But I think they're all interesting, and I present them all because we can learn something from all of them. So first is just, we can say that what they thought was going to happen in terms of micro-reductions in 1958, what they predicted, didn't pan out. We can also take into account some of the criticisms that reductionism just really isn't the way to go. And third, we can criticize the actual breakdown, the hierarchy, the six levels, and the rules that they had for setting up. So, failed predictions. The important thing to note is not that we failed to learn anything about social science by trying to reduce it to rational agents or like terms of game theory or something. We have learned a lot about it, but it just hasn't succeeded in the strong sense of micro-reduction that I presented earlier, that they're like free points, that logical operation. So we just haven't been able to take memory and reduce it to neurology. We haven't been able to take cellular biology and reduce it to genetics. When we do cellular biology, we talk about genetics, but that's not the only thing. And so so genetics just isn't giving us all the information that we need to do cellular biology. Same thing with chemistry and physics. Even though in quantum mechanics we can give a really good description of the hydrogen atom, once it gets much more complicated than the hydrogen atom, we give up on the physics and we do chemistry. So you can always just reply, wait and see, eventually this will happen. But just because these predictions haven't panned out in the way that they expect, that's a reason to question the model. And then there's these arguments against reductionism. Two famous ones by Jerry Fodor and Alan Dorfingel. Fodor's idea is that we can't reduce something like money in economics, the natural kind of money, down to physics, because the laws that we'd need to go through all these steps of reduction would be wildly disjunctive. Not only would we have to have laws about how, like, the physical, well, think about it this way. Money can be physically instantiated in a huge number of different ways. We can have dollar bills, we can have coins, we can have electrons floating in a database in a bank. These all represent money. And so if your physical theory is trying to keep track of not only all the actual instantiations of money, but all the counterfactual instantiations of money, all the ways money could be physically instantiated, then you're just going to get completely lost. So this is what he's arguing, that that no physical theory will be able to capture these like higher-level objects, higher-level natural kinds. And Fodor's paper has been criticized too. I like Garfinkel's idea better. I'll read what I have. So he argues along the lines that a micro explanation just isn't going to be an answer to a macro level question. So if we're asking why this rabbit was eaten, we could answer that because it ran into fox F at time t in place p. Or we could answer that the fox population was high. And the higher level explanation is kind of taking into account more counterfactual circumstances, like if that rabbit hadn't been eaten at that time and place, would have been eaten at some other time and place, because there's lots of foxes. So there's, Garfinkel argues that you're trying to explain things in two different ways, and you should answer the question at the level that it was asked, and not just try and reduce it. There's lots on reductionism. And then the last one is the idea that this hierarchy that they have really just isn't what we want. First of all, things like biology and chemistry span a couple of their levels, like biology spans cells and multicellular things. Other perfectly good sciences like astronomy and geology just don't seem to fit into their scheme. Like astronomy would cover three levels. And the other thing is that if you're going to distinguish cells and like molecules by complexity, why aren't you distinguishing something like the sun and a galaxy, which is in kind of a similar relation, or rocks and mountains, or a number of these different things that seem to be very different in complexity. So the essential problem is that some big things are simple, some little things are complicated, so they're not capturing all our intuitions. So lessons learned: if we're going to improve, we have to kind of allow for more autonomy in the social sciences, don't just accept reduction. We have to provide a better account of reduction, and we have to have a more flexible view. So that's what my model is going to try to do. So the first step is to collect some tools. How are we going to like compare the complexity of like cell and a multicellular living thing, or organisms and social groups? We can do it in a bunch of different ways. The first idea is just by like grain size. So if I look at something with a microscope, and that's the only way I can see it, other things I can see with the naked eye, then probably the microscopic thing's on kind of a different grain size. So we're just making rough divisions in the set of all the things on the basis of their size. very simple, but in general it seems to work because a rock is a little thing, but mountains are made out of rocks, even if they're big things on a bigger scale. The problem is that size just isn't everything. So if you're going to compare like a mountain, which is a huge thing, but it's just a bunch of rocks, to a cat that is small but intricate and incredibly complicated, then brain size just isn't going to cut it. So it doesn't meet all the intuitions that we have. The next one, which Oppenheimer and Putnam tend to rely on, is this part-whole relation. Something, if you can break something like a cat down into organs and tissues and cells, subcellular mechanisms down into molecules and molecule atoms, that seems to give you like more levels between elementary particles and a cat than between elementary particles and a mountain. So even though a mountain's bigger, in a certain sense, it doesn't have these like all these stages of levels in between. So that's interesting. But there's also other intuitions that aren't captured. Like if we have a chunk of water, exactly the same molecules in it, and it's frozen in one instance, and a crashing wave in another instance, it seems that the waves are more complicated than the frozen ice. Or maybe another intuition, if we have a cat that's alive and a cat that's dead, they're exactly the same. They have exactly the same molecules in them. The living cat seems to be more complicated, even though it has the same number of parts. So this doesn't seem to capture the relationships between the parts. And so there's a mathematical theory, which I won't go into, that allows it. There's a bunch of them that allow us to talk about complexity in more sophisticated ways. One's called Shannon information theory, one's called Modrow complexity theory. Another one is called just entropy, physical entropy. These notions are related, and I'm working on how they're related. So we can actually get a mathematical understanding of this. But we don't have to go into this in much more depth because the parts wholes will give us just about everything we need. So we'll ignore this slide. The essential is that in order to compare like the parts and wholes in a mountain or in a cat, or then we need to agree on what counts as a part. Is just this like big shape of a rock count as a part, or is it only molecules that count as a part, or is it fault lines that somehow distinguish one part of a mountain from another, or in cats? So we need to have a common language and kind of a common set of objects before we can start breaking things up. And that's the next step. So in order to define this common language and in order to define this domain of objects, we'll kind of start with the idea about what a science is, and then we'll build from there. So this allows us to apply our complexity tools. So we define a science in this rough kind of sense. I know there's problems in the practical application of these things, but we're worried about the in-principle stuff right now. So we define a science just by defining a community of scientists who are interested in the same kind of thing. So the community of biologists are interested in biological things, insofar as they're biologists. And when they're talking about biological things, they have this technical language that involves these jargon words, technical words, that new biologists have to be trained in before they can enter into the conversation about biology. So we're interested in this in the domain of objects, and we're also interested in the language. And so the domain of objects will define the wholes, and the language will help us to define the parts. And then we can start breaking those objects and the domains down into the parts and comparing the complexity. The domains will also have basic, what I call elementary objects, which are going to be objects that don't have any parts inside that domain. So inside the domain of inside the domain of biology, we might draw the line at, say, organic chemistry or something. So organic in, or maybe, say, the better idea is to talk about inside the domain of biology, we might define the basic parts of cells, and then we just because of the way we've divided up the domains in the language, we don't have any parts within biology that are able to talk about things smaller than cells, for example. It's not a particularly good example, but there are going to be things that have that are the simplest things within the domain, and they're interesting because they define the core of the domain if we're comparing these complexities. The top of the domain doesn't have to be as clearly defined. So So these are the kind of ways it could break down. We can compare two different domains, A and B. These are three examples of B. By taking an elementary object in A and asking where it shows up in B. So maybe we have biology is domain A, and then we're talking about a cell, and so the box will represent cell as like an elementary object. And then maybe in domain B, a cell is one of the parts of a more complicated whole. So it's a part of an elementary object, in which case that domain will be at a higher level of complexity. Or maybe that part can be the cell. Maybe this is chemistry. It can be broken down into molecules or atoms or something. So in which case chemistry is at a lower level of complexity. So that's kind of the way that we can start to compare these domains. So we don't have an absolute measure, but we have these interesting relative measures that allow us to get kind of a partial ordering of them. Or if there's two domains within a bigger domain, we can compare them with respect to the domain that encompasses both of them. So these levels of complexity are a lot more complicated than Oppenheim and Putnam's levels of complexity. But that's a good thing, because we needed them to be more complicated. We can have things that are breaking down into parts in one domain, shared in one domain, or all over the place. And so these levels aren't really robust levels anymore. They're kind of like layers or measures of how complex things are. So those are the tools that we need. And now we get to this new model. The idea is we want to talk about a bunch of sciences. We distinguish the sciences by kind of separating them off into communities of sciences. That allows us to define the domain and the language, which will allow us to make these comparisons among those. So this is my artist impression of the new hire. It's not the scale. So the first thing to notice is that it's a lot bigger and messier than Oppenheim and Putnam's hierarchy. But that's what we wanted. We have like chemistry, which is a big field, and then we can talk about more specialized like subfields of chemistry. We can talk about where chemistry and geology overlap. We can talk about where like astronomy spanning all these levels. We can compare the complexity of a galaxy maybe to the complexity of a mind maybe. The practicalities are going to be ugly, but in principle, I'm arguing that this kind of thing is possible, or at least it's interesting to try and do these kind of things. So when we're doing cognitive science might be this block that's involving some high-level biology and psychology and maybe even a little of social science. And now that we have these ideas about relating levels together, we can start to make connections. We can ask, how complicated is this neural circuit? How complicated is a belief with regard to a neural circuit? And we can begin to have kind of objective measurements about where these things all go together. We have lots of intuitions about how parts and wholes are related, but we don't really have all that many objective tools. So that's what I'm trying to develop, and I'm trying to avoid the technical stuff here, but I'm just pointing to it. So the advantages are that we abandon this idea of micro-reduction, which really didn't seem to be working, in favor of this idea of connections between scientific domains. So I haven't really given you anything on this here today, but the idea is that we have local reductions between systems or sets of objects in one field to another. We don't have global reductions where all of psychology is reduced to neuroscience. So that's interesting. We preserve the autonomy of sciences and kind of a weaker sense of the unity of science than all of Oppenheim and Putnam were talking about. And we have a lot more room for sciences. We've actually divided up into kind of this world of objects along the lines that the sciences are actually dividing the world instead of just cells, multi-cellular things. So the problems are that it's much messier, and that the details of this are going to be complicated to actually implement. It's going to get ugly when you actually want to distinguish who belongs to a scientific community, who doesn't, or define these domains, or define languages, or actually applying these complexity measures. So the work that I'm continuing to do on this topic involves just trying to make these things more practical, trying to I think I've convinced myself that this is a better conceptual framework for doing interdisciplinary sciences, like cognitive science. So the trick is now to convince cognitive scientists that it's a good idea and try and give them tools to actually use it for people in other interdisciplinary sciences. So what I haven't given you is a whole new way of doing science that's just radically different than everything that we've done before. It's perfect down to the last detail. There's lots of problems, lots of philosophical problems about language and communities and metaphysical problems, ontological problems. There's a lot more work to be done. But what I do hope that I've provided is just kind of a new, more general, more interesting way of looking at the sciences and looking at connections between the sciences, which will help us overcome some of these barriers of specialization and make connections between these specialized fields and enable people to do interdisciplinary science, like cognitive science. So I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions. If I don't get to answer your questions, feel free to email me. And these are a couple of papers that I referred to. And that's it.
My question is about the slides with connecting domains. I don't know if pointing is easier than explaining.
I have a laser pointer, right? This one?
No, it's called
this one?
Domains. Yes. So take a cell into domain A. You want to look at the cell in physics.
Okay.
What's your criterion of identity between the two domains and the thing? What I mean is this. You can prove stuff in physics that you can't prove in biology, the other way around too. So literally, the conceptual role of the cell isn't the same for the variables.
Right.
The same question can be asked about the loss between the two levels. And I guess that's a different question.
Maybe it's not a different question. It's a very good question, and I haven't explained anything about it here, but I have thought about it quite extensively. So it requires kind of an understanding of ontology that gets actually ends up getting somewhat flaky. So the arguments against reduction are exactly that: cells are one thing, and elementary particles are another thing. No matter how many elementary particles together you get together, in a certain sense you don't have a cell, like Foss cell in biology, you have the parts of a cell. Okay. So, as a sketch of an answer, the ontology that I kind of favor gives up on these objects in a strong sense and starts talking about patterns and relationships between objects. And so there's a couple. And then we have to have ways of defining patterns, which involves stuff like information theory, measuring signals and noise, kind of ratios and stuff. So the kind of people that I read that do this kind of thing, Dan Dennett came up with a paper in 91 called Real Patterns, where the idea is that we don't have real objects, but we have like real patterns. When we're doing biology, we look at the world through kind of a lens of biology, and we take the kind of boiling mess that is the world, and we separate it up into biological units. When we're doing physics, we divide it up in another way. So the idea is to take the pattern in biology and look at it from this physical perspective. And then, so we don't, it's not an object as a cell in the strongest sense. It's just kind of this pattern, and we look at it in a couple different ways. So it's not the kind of thing I was going to try and explain in this kind of paper. I have thought about it. I wasn't sure I could convince anybody about it. But yeah, we can talk about that later. Do you want to follow up? Or?
So say I take this Catherine's view. Mm-hmm. In this case, the translation between the two languages needs to be done in a math language, which, among other things, is sees the world as a totality, as if it were available. And then you have two lenses.
Maybe all the meta language needs is like spatiotemporal frames or something. So we look at this cell. It's defined in a particular space. We look at it. We look at this same space and time from physics, and we see different patterns and things. So I don't know if the meta language has to be equally robust. Like we need to match up frames with reference. That's a good point, but I'm not sure that's the end of the world.
Comment or question. Uh-huh. My comment is if you can see an example of this ideal of unified science in Plato's Timaeus, which starts out with infinitely divisible, I can't say elementary triangles, but infinitely divisible, it goes way up eventually into politics.
Yeah.
So I just throw that out to you. The question that I have is, what do you mean by a part? Do you mean the spatial part, or do you mean, and I'm very baffled by complexity of putting these spatial parts together, or do you include in parts things like shape and size and color and all kinds of properties like that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Right. Well, short answer is that the space-time thing is a lot easier to deal with. I don't consider properties to be parts in the sense because I want to say that holes will have properties, parts will have properties. They're not necessarily the same properties. Only a certain relation of parts inside this hole gives rise to this kind of property of a whole. I'm not being a crazy emergentist or anything, but I think that makes perfect sense. So the easiest way to talk about parts and holes is in terms of spatiotemporal stuff. Maybe there's a better way to do it. And I don't go as far as saying that properties are parts in this kind of thing. So it's a very kind of physical, tangible sense of parts that I'm working with right now.
Another question about parts. You probably don't want to think of like very tiny piece of a mountain as a part of a mountain. It's not interesting, right? So you want some kind of other categorization of what things get to count as parts. I was wondering, just do you trust the special science in question to tell you what the interesting objects are? Or do you have some perspective from outside? Or do you go to a different special science to tell you which are the important parts?
Well, that's a good question. I try and get around that kind of problem by trusting the special science to tell me what the parts are. So there aren't any sciences that care about arbitrary blobs in a mountain, and so we won't care about it either. The model does allow that in the future, or maybe someone becomes interested in these kind of things, and we can fit this into the scheme. As long as we can start talking about the translation of what they consider a part into a hole at another level, or a bunch of parts at another level. So I think that's okay. And it ends up being like very anthropocentric in the way that we're looking at the world. But that I'm happy with that. Sciences are anthropocentric, and I don't think we should be upset about that. And this like patterns ontology that I'm talking about, it does that same kind of thing. Like different people will see different patterns based on what they're interested in, and that's perfectly fine. And so we kind of let go of objects in some absolute sense, and instead grab hold of patterns. But what we're not doing is going completely relativist about this, because we can, using the mathematics of information theory or other kind of things, we can say that this is a pattern and this is random. And so it might be quite hard to actually build a coherent science that talks about like arbitrary blobs inside a mountain, just because you need something in the world to grab onto. There's got to be some information in the world for you to start this pattern out of, kind of thing. So anyway, that gets complicated, but that's the idea.
This might be a broader question.
Yeah, I like this.
When you're talking about the barriers between subjects, how everything seems to be increasingly specialized and that sort of thing, I guess I'm just not sure what the problem is exactly. Because if you are in
philosophy and you're interested in the big problem of the mind and you start getting into neuroscience and cognitive psychology, it seems that you just learn what you need to learn in order to make up for your deficit to address the problem that you're faced with. Mm-hmm. So, and it seems to me that even though things are increasingly specialized, it goes back and forth. So you might find out or discover or learn something in a specialized field, be able to reduce it right back into physics, but it can also go the other way. So I'm not sure what the barriers are exactly.
Right. So like the individual neuroscientist, I've had this conversation with my friend before who's in neuroscience. He doesn't care about psychology in particular, right? He's working on neuroscience, and that's fine. And that's great. And so so he doesn't care about this. But the people working in cognitive science are kind of fumbling, trying to figure out ways in which they can just communicate with each other about these kind of things. So it's not like they can go and read papers from psychology and they can go and read these things. And that's fine for particular cases. And it's been working. But if this model works as well as I hope it will, it'll give us some kind of like rules, a little bit more of a structure or framework for drawing these connections. And so it'll give us, if it works, it would give us an idea of where to look for profitable connections between neuroscience and psychology, and where not to look, and that kind of thing. So the hope is that it'll constrain our thinking in profitable ways by focusing on things where we expect good connections to be and ignoring ones where they won't. So that didn't answer your question.
Well, I just think within each field, probably if you're a person within neuroscience, you would start to, I mean, if you were investigating something particular, you would start to see where an understanding of philosophy might be beneficial. And then, so the people in those fields probably know where those connections are going to be.
See, okay, and it's the probably know thing that I'm trying to improve on. So we have intuitions about how these connections are going to be made, and sometimes they're very good intuitions, right?
Yeah.
But if we can get a model, then we can layer in intuitions on the table, and we can argue over them. If the intuitions are just in our heads, then we're kind of talking past each other, right? So I'm trying to just, we have intuitions about logic, but a formalism of logic extends our intuitions in interesting ways. So that's how I see it. So we have intuitions about how sciences are connected together, but if we can build an interesting model, we can first of all argue about it in a reasonable way and try and improve it, and second of all, apply it to cases where we don't have intuitions or strong intuitions.
Is that correct?
You have my email, right?
So, any more questions
from the email? James? I'm afraid we're actually out of time. We have to get up and take a short break for the next call.
We're 10 minutes behind schedule, so we'll be back in 10 minutes for the next. Sorry, James.